Hello and welcome to episode 12 of season 3 of the Zach Thinkshare podcast. Today I'm really excited. I got to talk with Eve Rodsky last week, and she is, for many of you already know this, some of you don't know, she's the author of the book Fair Play. I am a Fair Play facilitator. I got my start in coaching, I think, significantly through being a Fair Play facilitator. And I got to ask her a good amount of questions, as I think I've had a lot of insecurities that I've been implementing her book and the method appropriately in the programming. And we got a lot of answers, whether I'm doing it right or doing it wrong in her eyes. And I think that's probably the highest praise that I could have got, as I know that she's probably worked with the most couples in implementing Fair Play and helping them figure out those roadblocks. So in the show notes, I'll leave my book recommendations referral link. You guys can get the Fair Play book. I am running Fair Play 101 for people that are trying to get help navigating those early conversations with Fair Play and starting implementation. Alyssa and I are going to be working on building out Fair Play 102, which will be the long-term program where people are getting help implementing it in a group setting. So without further ado, here is Eve Rodsky. Actually, real quick, if you could do me a favor and click the subscribe button, really helps me out wanting to do more of these episodes, as podcasting is my smallest platform. So I'd love to deliver more things to you, and I look forward to sharing more of it with you. Hello and welcome to the Zach Think Share podcast. Today is brought to you by Fair Play, and today we have Eve Rodsky, the author of the Fair Play book that has significantly changed our marriage. Alyssa and I have reflected back on, if I hadn't gone through this, like, we would not be in the same place we are, and I've turned talking about this into a career, and I was just shared with Eve for the first time that she didn't know that I was doing this full time as a job, as implementing her book.
So exciting.
So Eve, thank you so much for taking the time today to talk with us. I think that there are tons of interviews that you do on podcasts, and I think a lot of them are speaking to the women audience. As much as 93% of my audience is women, I have a lot of direct work that I've done with men. And so I'm going to be looking forward to sharing with you some of the tactics that I've been doing, and I'm looking forward to hearing some of your direct critiques on them. And we're going to be speaking a little bit more to some of the men today, I think. So thank you again for coming on today.
Oh, Zach, well, you're already my favorite facilitator because your name is Zach and you spell it with an H, and my son is Zach with an H. So, you have my favorite name. So it was already going to be like a no-brainer, but I really do want to say thank you for your work. I think it's incredibly, obviously, important. That's just the baseline. But even more than that, I think sort of the vulnerability and the compassion you bring to it is a model, I think, that, and curiosity. You know, a lot of people have their mind made up because gender roles have been so ingrained in their lives, and it's not their fault. But I think the curiosity you bring to things is what I'm always so, so surprised by. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Well, let's start off with some curiosity.
Right, so please.
One of the main things that I coach couples and I coach in the guys to do is to have a weekly meeting. So I know in your book, a lot of times I even cite this as I'm teaching them this, is that in your book, you talk a lot about like having high frequency meetings, and your goal is to have daily ones. And I think honestly, between me and Alyssa, we do have daily ones, but they're very nonchalant.
Right.
And I know also in the documentary, you guys were walking while doing them. And I've seen, you know, a lot of guys. So I coach to do a weekly meeting in a very specific place in the home, ideally not somewhere you normally spend, so that you can sit down at the dining room table, which you never go to. And then your partner can see you sitting there and they're like, why the hell are they sitting? Oh, that's right. We're having our meeting right now. So you can have that nonverbal communication for, you know, starting the meeting. I also recommend having, you know, bring some candy or ice cream or a little bit of wine, because I think it is a awkward first thing to try to implement in your home.
Yes.
And having some dopamine there that makes you want to show up helps. And so I'm curious. So we call it the boring meeting in our home, because we kick it off with like what's on the calendar for the next 2 weeks. What, you know, Mother's Day is coming up. What do you want to do for that? Or I coach to say, like, give a multiple choice question. I recommend that the guys run the meeting, and they certainly invite the women to add whatever they want to the agenda, but to come planning with like a minimum, like 4 bullet points, and start off with scheduling. And then after a couple of weeks, you've gotten that basic habit down, start talking more about emotions, and then start implementing the cards and like looking at, hey, nighttime routine's been really crappy lately. Let's talk about the minimum standard of care of that. What would be maybe your critiques that you might add, or things that you've seen have worked really well with people implementing that?
Well, definitely no critiques. I mean, that is exactly right. All I would say is that, as you know, but maybe your listeners don't know, that the Fair Play system, even though you and I call it a system, it's really a secret formula, more like a secret formula of three things. It's boundaries, systems, and communication. And so often, and you know, we'll get into the boundaries and the systems, but the good news, I think, is if you're already listening to this podcast, hopefully you have a partner who believes that your time is valuable. And that's really the boundary piece that we'll talk about. That's probably the hardest to get people to the table. But once you're already at the table or willing to come to the table, you really have to decide whether you want to jump into systems or communication. And as you were saying, Zach, we have to start with communication first. And I tell the story that happened after, you know, during the pandemic, that happened after I started writing for a while, but it was during the pandemic. And it was that there was this group, you may have heard me say this before, but there was this group out of the UK called The Reasons I Hate My Husband and The Reason I Hate My Partner and Kids During COVID. And so people pointed me to this group because it was mostly women venting in a 27,000 member Facebook group. And so what I found interesting about it was one woman posted, or someone tagged me in this post, which was a woman saying, if my husband dies during the pandemic, it's not going to be because of the disease. It's going to be because of me. Yep. So, right. So she, you know, there's a lot of like up, you know, thumbs up or whatever. And so I found this so interesting. So I reached out to her, had my team reach out to her, and she responded, which I thought was really kind, in a DM. And she said, oh, you know, you're researchers and you deal with, communication in the home. Thank you for reaching out. And what we asked her was, how do you communicate with your partner in the home? And what she said back was very telling about what you just said. She said, We don't communicate about domestic life in our home. It's too triggering. This is my safe space. So what I want your listeners to reflect on is that this woman felt that publicly threatening to murder her partner in front of 27,000 strangers felt safer to her than doing what you just said, coming to the table to talk to her partner. And so that's why your step-by-step method of even just getting people to the table for how to communicate is so important, because we're in a place now where people are so afraid to approach their partners about these fair play topics of who does what in the home or how to organize the home, because probably they've tried and it has not gone well. And I think that's the big key, is that if we can start looking at communication, not as a start. So as that woman said, she doesn't talk about, you know, how to divide up things or anything about our home life because it's too triggering. What she's basically saying is, I can't start this conversation. So what we need to convince people of, and what you're doing so well, is that actually it's not a start of a conversation, because she's already communicating. She just publicly threatened to murder you in front of 27,000 strangers. You guys are already communicating. Zach can go onto your Nest Cam tomorrow and see 6 ways without even having audio that you've communicated about domestic life. So I think it's this idea that we're asking for a shift in communication, not a start. And once you recognize that you're already communicating about home life, then what you're saying, Zach, is the perfect shift. Instead of the feedback in the moment, God damn it, you forgot the Taekwondo bag again. You're not doing this feedback in the moment, nails on the chalkboard communication. You're actually, as you said, Zach, sitting down when emotion is low and cognition is high. So I can't really critique what you're doing at all, except for to say that we need to get more people to do that. And maybe if we explain to them that it's not a start, but it's a shift, then maybe we can get some, you know, more traction for people to come to those check-ins that you're, you know, that you're so beautifully suggesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me, I was working with a guy back in October, and he was, you know, we'd come to the call and we'd reflect on the challenges that he was having with his partner. They would get into, you know, tough disagreements in the moment. And I remember he was talking about his partner thought he was going to drive her to the airport. Meanwhile, he had something scheduled at that time that she ought to have been pretty aware of, because that was the whole reason for the trip that he was there. And he's like, well, I would be missing half of the game that I was there with my friends that I haven't seen forever. And so there was this moment of, I said, that ended up, you know, turning into a not great conversation. I said, someone, emotional labor is happening. The question, who's doing it when? And I said, so what you ended up, neither of you chose to do emotional labor in that moment.
Right.
And you just both let it out and it went terribly. So there are a couple opportunities you had, is you could have bit your tongue in that moment, and that would have been the emotional labor that you were doing. You could have, she could have done the emotional labor of, you know, asking a question beforehand, which she chose not to do. So similar to kind of what you're saying, yeah, is like communication are happening. We don't think of it as communication often. I think similarly, like when something goes wrong in your home, for example, like our toddler has had a double ear infection for like a month now. Ugh. We're getting ear tube soon. And we've had multiple moments where she's tantruming in a way that she's never done before. And we've been, well, I'll be honest, Alyssa has been doing more of the research than I have. And I've been hearing her spark notes of it. And we've been having a lot of these moments where she'll be tantruming. At some point, I kept trying to like help with the parenting or stepping in, or like, she would say milk and I would get the milk ready in the other room and stay like incognito across the wall. And there are multiple moments where Alyssa would come in, like, you know, she spent, you know, doing emotional labor, trying to manage her patience with our toddler. And I'm trying to do the emotional labor for Alyssa so that she doesn't have to deal with my upset around her being short with me.
Right.
So the emotional labor is happening in and around us all over the place. If we can start acknowledging it and labeling it, that's a huge difference. This brings me to my next question. So a lot of women come to me in the DM saying, besides showing your videos, which she doesn't watch anymore, first I say, like, if you're going to send one of my videos, add context. Don't just context. Send it and like silent. Say like, hey, this reminds me of a conversation we had the other day that articulates what I was trying to say the other day. Because I think when you add your own voice to it, it gives it, but you're doing a little bit more emotional labor for how it's going to be received. Similarly, I say, they're like, yeah, he still doesn't get it. Like, how do I help him? And so I'm curious where you've seen traction happening, and if this is like something, again, to hear your critique on. As I often say, you're already doing emotional labor. This is just another way that you could be doing it that might be more effective. When he comes home talking about his job and he's complaining about how his boss, you know, needs his ego stroked for the first 15 minutes before he can even have the damn meeting. just say to your partner, hey, it sounds like you do a lot of emotional labor for your boss. Similar, like, you know, let's say their manager and one of their employees never fills out their time card. And you're like, God damn it, he did it again. I'm going to have to email him on Monday and remind him to do it. And then he's probably not going to get paid. He's going to be pissed. Wow. It sounds like you do a lot of mental load. You manage a lot of the mental load for your employee there. And so what I'm kind of instructing them to do is look at what your partner's doing and use the words mental load and emotional labor in the context of what they're doing so that they can see it in a positive light. Cause I think we have the tendency to like, God, when are you going to understand? Like, I just own all the mental load in this house. And then mental load comes out as a subjective, you know, thing that they're not doing that they suck at, when in fact they're holding it in a lot of other places. So I recommend a lot of labeling.
I love labeling. I think that's a beautiful way to handle these situations. And look, I want to acknowledge to our, you know, mutual listeners or those who are here today that I got a lot of pushback, Zach, especially from my mother, who's a professor of social change, about why I decided to write to women. You know, Fair Play is, you know, men as you found it, right? It is a book that both, you know, any gender can read, but it's, there's a lot of anger in the beginning of the book. As one man said to me, you know, I should have just skipped halfway through because the first half made me hate you.
Yeah.
And I get it. You know, it can feel very abrasive because it's not gentle in the way that you are. And again, I appreciate your coaching, because I'm not a coach, I'm a lawyer. So I come at things very hostily. And so there is a lot of women rage in the beginning of the book. And I think that's important because we have to acknowledge, yes, we are asking the person who's quote unquote oppressed by this mental load, the conception and planning of every single thing for the household that's invisible, where you take an economic risk because your partner gets to stay in the workforce and you're doing all this unpaid labor. We are asking you to do more work to shift the dynamics. But it's sort of how I look at any onboarding. As a partner in a law firm, for example, I'm going to do more work up front to get my associate to get to the level of partner eventually. But when we have been conditioned in such a, for 2000 years to have assumptions instead of communication based on who does what in the home, yes, it's going to take the oppressed time to label and to have these conversations. So what I want to say is I understand that we wish men would just step up and start these conversations. Zach is obviously working on that. But if you are a person who is the one who needs to come to the table, I think part of it is just understanding and recognizing how painful it is. That because it is very painful. And for me, in the beginning of my relationship with Seth, when this was going south, when our second son, Ben, was born, it was very painful, Zach, because I didn't know how to get out of it. And so we do need coaching like you. And I think what I want to say is that, unfortunately, if you're in a situation where your partner won't come to the table, of course you need someone like Zach. But also, what you can start doing is only what you can do for yourself. And that was sort of similar to what I did, which was I started to change how I felt to myself. And that's that boundaries piece where I had to really do the internal work as a woman to say, what am I asking for? Why do I believe I can ask for what I need? Is my time as valuable as my partner's, even though Seth makes more money than me? So unfortunately, I do think we retreat from these conversations. We breach our boundaries so much, Zach, because we're so afraid to come back to the table because we aren't really sure that we deserve anything different. So, I mean, that's not an easy answer, but I will say what you're doing is exactly right on. But also, I think we can acknowledge to those women how painful it feels for somebody not to validate this as the work that we do as labor. It's horrible. It's really horrible to hear you what are you, a spa day? You're not interested. I mean, I've heard everything. In 16 countries, you eat bonbons all day. You chose not to work. I make your life. I bring home the money. So you're asking me to do, you know, Fair Play cards, you know, unpaid labor too. What are you, crazy? You know, you hear the gamut of gaslighting. And unfortunately, that's sort of why you have to continue to be on TikTok and do your reels, because I think that 101 of just understanding that those things are incredibly painful to hear, especially from men to women, is work that I think we'll probably have to do like literally the rest of our lives.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, I know you're a, you really look at the structure and the systems of a organization. And whenever people are saying like, I make her life, or like, I'm doing my job as bringing the money in. So I made a video. A lot of people, I think, appreciate this metaphor. When I point out that it's an organization, like you've talked about, proving is like, great, your sales, your marketing, you bring in the money, but like, what about operations? Like if the goal is to be an organization that delivers, you know, an experience to some customer, whether that's the children or, you know, the part of you that wants to live your life, like who's running operations, who's doing HR, which is the emotional labor center. and like thinking about all those departments when you can, I think because we're in this like capitalist society, we can map everything we think is valuable over to like corporate structure.
Absolutely.
So anytime we can be metaphoring in that direction, I think a lot of the guys will be able to pick it up a little bit better.
Absolutely. And by the way, you know, I think what's been so interesting lately, what I'm seeing, at least in some of the YPO groups I've been speaking to, is that, you know, fair play is a love letter to men, because we're starting to see really interesting things happen. Like we have, there's a new study that shows the people that have reduced their work hours the most are white collar men. So that's very exciting to see. And we're seeing things like men pick up books like Radical Candor and Servant Leadership. So again, in the workplace, I do think men are starting to think about what type of leader they want to be. And typically the way I try to get it over to the home side, because as you know, Zach, I believe that all leadership at work begins in the home. I start to say to men, you know, well, I really, unfortunately, it doesn't really matter whether you have radical candor or whether you're a servant leader. The only thing that really matters that I need to know about your leadership is whether or not you know the name of your child's dentist. Mm-hmm. And that's always a very provocative question, because either men do know the name of their dentist, or they take them to the dentist, or they don't. But sometimes I will get a line of men that just are there to tell me like Dr. Goldfarb is the name. And I think it's so funny because it's so literal. And I keep saying them when they're there. I'm like, thank you for telling me that your dentist is Dr. Goldfarb, but you understand this is a metaphor. It's a metaphor for, you know, are you the tooth fairy? You know, do you tell your employees that you're leaving early to go take your child to the doctor? And so they start to get it. But similar to what you say, some of those metaphors about leadership in the workplace beginning in the home is helpful, because I do think that we are in a capitalist society and we do benefit, given that we're not going to change that structure. We benefit from those types of metaphors.
Yeah. And you said that it's a love letter to men. And so I've had moments certainly of pushing back on this. I think you put out a good point. I was glad you said that. It's like there's some mom rage out in the beginning of the first two chapters. Now, I've never labeled it that way. One thing I do typically say, so, you know, when I'm in a first call meeting someone that's looking at my programming coaching, I'll say that are you familiar with Fair Play? If you're not, like, it's a book that's catered to women and speaking to their challenges. And I often say, like, it's not an easy book to get through.
It's not.
I think that for sure, those first couple chapters, like, brace yourself. I typically say, if I'm talking to a couple, I say, guys, get a chapter ahead, because she's going to hear that, feel very validated. And she might have some moments of like, yeah, see that thing? That's that thing you do. And then if he's blind and he's like, fuck, I don't know what she's talking about. He has no leg to stand on in that discussion. So the other thing that I do in my programs is I have discussion questions that I encourage guys to look at. And those were some of those first questions. So when I first read the book, I was like, okay, I only get to do this once as read. I know I have the feeling this is going to make a big difference for my audience. I only get to have a first reflection on this once. So I made a video for almost every chapter, like my initial reactions. And so a lot of were the things that I reflected on or what I said in those. I cringe a little bit every time that you say it's a love letter to men. Maybe say a little bit more about why.
It really is. All right, I'll tell you why. Feels that way. Okay, so the book, I would say what I'm saying is that I believe that the Fair Play movement is a love letter to men. Hmm. I don't think the book per se is a love letter to men. Gotcha. Because, you know, when you get identified as being like a guy who leaves, you know, a drunk guy's jacket on the lawn of your home for 16 hours, assuming someone else is going to pick it up, it doesn't feel like, and that's an anecdote in the book I tell about Seth, it doesn't feel in the moment like a love letter to men. But I think what my love of men is in how they've been receiving the book and how they've been using it, similar to you. So my love letter is to people like you, Zach, but there's also, you know, I'm going to read you something. Mm-hmm. And I, as a facilitator, you probably heard this beautiful message, but this came from Korea. And I'll tell you, these are the things that make fair play a love letter to men. So this is from a lawyer in Korea, and he writes, thank you message from Korea. Dear Ms. Rodsky, he sent this, you know, blind on LinkedIn. And I'm not going to say his name because he asked me not to share his name. This is family sort of high profile in Korea. Dear Ms. Rodsky, I read your book, Fair Play Project, and write this message to express gratitude for you. I bought this book as one of the husbands in the world, and I confess I thought I'm a fairly good husband, but I was wrong. So that's where, again, I apologize to men, because it's really not there to shame you, but I understand why. So that's not the part I like about this. I felt bad that that's what he had to receive. But then the rest was very positive. I strongly believe everybody must read this book before they got married or have a baby. Personally, I lost my sister, who was a high court judge and a mother of two elementary student sons 4 years ago. It was because a cerebral hemorrhage stroke took her. I believe this disease exploded as she worked too hard and handled too much things during her father-in-law's death, which was just a week before her death. She took care too many things as a full-time worker and as a perfectionist judge. I think if this Fair Play Project were spread over the whole of Korea and every husband executes this project, my sister would still be with us, having a balanced life with her smiling face, which I terribly, terribly miss. Thank you for writing this book, and I will practice this method from now on. That's why Fair Play is a love letter to men, because even though there are parts that can feel triggering and shaming, which was not my intention, but it does feel that way. You look at these men and you still were brave enough to put your ego aside, to be curious about why someone would write something so pejorative and possibly mean and condescending to men, and then say, there's a reason that this person wrote this, and then really get to the end, which was that men will enter care at some point in their lives, whether they take care of an aging relative or a child or a brother or a sister or have a family member die of literally the mental load in this case of this man. And so you're entering care. And so I just love when you are able to handle the sort of the possible, you know, shaming and stories that can feel so triggering and still get to the other side of the book. That's why it's a love letter to men.
Yeah. Yeah. It almost reminds me of like, I can't think of the movie, but I feel like there's a million movies where it's like the girlfriend is like, she's sick of his ways. She's like pushing him. She's like, why? Like she wants you to go chase her. And it's like, this is the pushing. This is the going away to her parents' house or something. And she wants you to come get to chapter like 4 and 5 with the stereo outside of her window.
Like, let's be the Lloyd Dobler with like the, you know, the boombox. But part of it is, and I think there is this one very small story that, again, I think I see a lot of yours resonant in this story that happened also during the pandemic of this couple named Richard and Amy. And I didn't write into the book because it was after, but the smallness of it, you know, makes me feel like when I see your steps, when you say like, just pick an area that's not familiar to you, like those matter. Because what's interesting about fair play is it can feel so big and intractable, like I can't even come to the table, but it also can feel so small. Like, Zach, you're really telling me that sitting down with coffee, you know, in a different area of my house is really going to help? And you're like, yes. And so this one story, like this couple, Richard and Amy, I changed their names, but this dad, and again, we're assuming people sort of understand, you know, that fair play is a metaphor. It's a card game of 100 cards that basically encourage partnership over helpership, where there's three phases of the work. There's the conception, understanding the work. There's the planning of the work. And then there's actually the doing of the work. And so of the 100 cards, this man, Richard, and Amy sort of came back to the table. They came back to the table because in full transparency, they thought they may be in the Fair Play documentary. So they wanted to sort of understand where they stood in their labor. And so what Richard is a typical older father. Amy's a younger mother. It's his second marriage. So again, sort of has different experiences. But so wanted to come to the table doing better for the second relationship already. Amy sort of works part-time and is younger. And he has older kids, but he has a younger daughter who at this time is about 6 years old. And what he realized about doing the cards with Amy or going through the cards again was that actually he reflected that he was great at what we call the green suit, the home suit. So he was doing like home maintenance. He does grocery shopping, especially because she was like super freaked out during the pandemic. So he did everything she wanted, like wipe down. Do you remember when we were wiping down groceries, Zach? Like, I mean, I wasn't, but there were people who were. He is very involved in the transporting of his daughter to school. So that's the out suit. So those are two suits, home and out. But then there's these other two suits of the cards, which we call caregiving and magic. And what was interesting was he noticed that in caregiving and magic, he really didn't hold any of those cards. And that is where a lot of the emotional labor happens, as Zach teaches, right? It's, there may be some things you can outsource, but that's sort of a fallacy because there's still 50 cards in caregiving and magic that typically, as much as you love your nanny Alexia, she's not deciding whether your child's adenoids are being taken out, as Zach is dealing with with Alyssa right now and his child. So of those cards, one of those cards is called Magical Beings. I love the Tooth Fairy card. I love Santa because it's so interesting how couples divide up that labor. So he decides he's going to take on the Magical Beings card and CPE it, be in charge of it, know when it has to happen, be the Tooth Fairy. So his daughter had, frame of reference, had already lost a tooth before. So she had understood what the Tooth Fairy was. So the night that he's Tooth Fairy and took over intentionally that card, the Tooth Fairy doesn't come. So the reason why I'm telling the story is because I love the way they reflect on what life was like in the small details before Fair Play and after. So before Fair Play, the typical reaction, similar to what we were just talking about, from Richard, back to what—
Why didn't you remind me?
Right, right. You know, you, why didn't you remind me? Like, it's your fault. Because if you had reminded me, I would have done it. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that you already know his reaction even without knowing the story. And then Amy's reaction was, she admitted she was a verbal assassin. She would have said things like, I can never trust you again. Mm-hmm. All or nothing language. You ruined our child's magic of her life. So those don't feel, I don't think that would feel good to you, Zach, if you heard those things, right? And then he would minimize her experience by saying things like, what's the fucking big deal? It's just one night. And so then you get into this horrible cycle. Post Fair Play, Richard says he does the small thing of accountability, which you talk a lot about, Zach, right? Understanding that all he had to say was, I messed up. Mm-hmm. I had this responsibility and I didn't wake up early enough. I passed out last night. I didn't wake up early enough before our daughter wakes up to put the money under the pillow. By him taking that accountability,
she doesn't feel like
Amy
she needs,
backed
she
needs off.
Anything. Yeah.
Right. She just backed off. She said, okay, carry through your mistake. So what the resolution of this story was that Richard is still the Tooth Fairy because he emailed toothfairy@gmail.com.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And apparently he gets a response. And the woman beautifully said, it turns out it is a woman, it's some dentist. So thank you, whoever you are out there, for doing this emotional labor for parents. And she said something like, sorry, I couldn't get you. The supply chain was backed up during COVID of teeth. And what he said, he printed out this email and said, look, the Tooth Fairy got back to me. And she says, when she comes late, she brings double the money. And that was it. That is the end of that story. The Tooth Fairy came the next night, brought double the money, and he's still the Tooth Fairy. So I don't know. I love that story because it's small, but we all have interactions like that. And I feel like the more we practice that accountability and trust cycle, the more that, you know, we're going to be in much better care relationships as we move forward in life, especially men.
Yeah. And I think those weekly meetings that I am always proposing, I think what I've seen in our relationship and our dynamic, as well as a lot of other guys, is that when you are setting that like vulnerability container, where it's like, you're showing up to talk about hard things, you're coming emotionally prepared for those tough conversations. you're more careful with your words. You're not being that verbal assassin when you might be in the moment and like right. you're having those moments of like, I'm having a really hard time with you saying that right now. Right. And you're doing the emotional labor in that moment. And then like when you're showing your partner verbally and non-verbally that you're doing the emotional labor to manage your tone and you're improving, like they're going to want to come meet you halfway a lot more.
Absolutely.
Too.
I totally agree with that.
As you were talking about, so another question that I have for you, which is similarly, I know you say that it's a card game. And oftentimes when people say, yeah, we tried the card game, and I often pause them, I say, didn't feel like a game, didn't it? And I say, I usually say that it's like a conversation starter, because I think it's like, it's a structure to start conversations that you're not having. And I know it definitely markets like a game, I think. It definitely doesn't play like one.
Right.
Have you, what do you usually tell people around that?
Well, this is my feeling. And Zach, it was a really hard decision because my publisher really wanted to release, as you said, sort of the card game. Mm-hmm. As you say, we call it a conversation deck because it's not really a game. It doesn't feel like a game. It can feel very triggering, as we talked about. But what was interesting was that they really wanted to release the card deck with the book because it's a little confusing, right? I'm proposing to these publishers in 2016 that chores and housework are actually 100 different tasks. So that's confusing at first for them as well. And then on top of it, I sort of want to write a card game exercise into a book. And so they didn't really understand that. They're like, is this like Cards Against Humanity or is this a book? And I'm like, no, it's both. And so writing a card game into a book was very confusing for many publishers, but luckily Penguin Random House took a chance on me. And then on top of it, they also wanted to release the cards with the book because the metaphor is a card game. And it's weird to give a book that says this is a card game or a conversation deck without the deck. So actually we pushed back because we didn't want to release the cards for a whole year because we needed, and even now I would probably not have released the cards until maybe now where there's people like you out there, there's social media, there's context. It's back to what you said earlier. There is context. If you see just this card game and you don't have the context, you didn't read the book, you didn't get coached by Zach, and you come to the table with these cards and you like skim over the instructions and you take 30 minutes to read them, it's a fucking disaster.
Yeah.
It's a literal disaster. And so that is just the truth. The truth is that what we see, and we're actually getting, you know, hopefully some hot off the presses data soon that we'll, you know, hopefully you'll get to talk about online. But what I know of 10 years of doing this work is that knowing about fair play and not implementing it makes relationships worse. It does. Because if you unleash consciousness without a solution, it's worse. It's sometimes better. Ignorance is bliss. I think there's a reason that that is a very, you know, time-worn phrase.
Yeah.
However, if you practice once learning about these issues, it is, and we're, again, we'll get you the data to prove this because we have it now, your relationship is remarkably better. Mm. It just is. So you have to get through that dip though. And that's why we need the Zachs of the world, because otherwise without the Zachs of the world, people are going to just use the card game and do harm.
Yeah. And they're
going
to do what you did in your book, which is throw your shit I do list at your partner in therapy.
Yes. Right. And say, just fucking take something, just take something. And then Seth, look at me like, what the hell are you talking about? I literally have no idea what you're talking about.
And I have a critique that I offer to the guys in my program. So again, start off with those boring meetings, get that habit in place, start talking about feelings, get that comfortable container, then introduce cards. And what I do is, so I just call it the 51% exercise. So this is what me and Alyssa did, because we only had like, I think 2.5 hours or 3 hours for the first time we sat down with the card deck. And I think in your book, you had talked about doing like a real deep dive, taking a break, getting back into your deep dive. And I think it's ideal and it's challenging as shit to implement.
Absolutely.
So what I typically have people do is I say, sit down with the cards, or I often talk about, I don't know if you're aware of the Persist app that I think is doing a pretty good job of like doing a digital version of it.
Amazing.
And you look at each card and you say, who owns 51% of this currently? And okay, Zach owns this one. Okay. And then you just get through, so you have a general idea of where the decks are and which ones are not relevant to you. When we first did it, we knocked out 36 cards, 44 were hers, about 20 were mine.
Great.
From there, we recognize, all right, Alyssa probably is owning full 100% of her cards. Zach probably owns 51 to 80% of his cards.
I love
that. Instead of taking the one that she already owns 100% of and saying, Zach, let's you take a card, any card. Instead, let's take one of the ones that Zach already owns a good amount of. In that
love
case,
it.
When we first did was dishes. I was almost every night doing it, but it was always, I remember one of the moments I hated the most before we implemented was got up off the couch. I'm like, I'm going to get out of these dishes. Like, we had gotten a hell of fresh that night. There's two or three times more dishes when we do that.
Yes, always. I know.
And I was like, I'm just going to get ahead of this. Like, there's a part of me that's like, she'll be proud of me. She'll be glad that this is handled. As I get up off the couch, she says, Zach, can you do the dishes tonight? I'm like, mother, I was going to do them.
That,
and I
right,
get no
exactly,
credit
yes,
now
yes,
for having done them. So, our first conversation was we said, okay, Zach's going to manage dishes. Let's define what that is, create the minimum standard of care, and Zach's going to do trash as well. She still hadn't read the book at that point. I had just read it and I was bringing the cards to her. So I came to her with the list of, I think it was like 20-ish things.
By the way, thank you, Alyssa. Thank you, Alyssa, for having to hear this over and over and over again. We love you.
So I brought this to her, and the other coaching I give is have an iterative conversation. So, had like the first week we implemented it, and the goal was next week to talk about it again and say,
love it.
What went wrong? How can we make an adjustment to it? And she's like, all right, one more thing I want to add is I want you to put in some soap and like, just do a quick 45 second scrub of the sink, especially, and add bleach if there was like raw chicken in there. And so that was, our minimum standard of care probably took me maybe 20 minutes to think about, to put into, put on a piece of paper, and I put it under a plastic sheet so I could check mark it. I think I used the check boxes two nights, and then I was like, this is a lot of check boxes. I'm just going to like use this as I'm going to do everything that I remember to do and then come back to it and check off what's there. And then eventually I kind of just said, I used that, but I just got rid of the things that I knew really well to do and just kept the things on the list that I would always forget to do, to the point where it was a habit. And we've never really redone.
Are you going to do this for teenagers, please? I hope your practice can go into teenagers, because that's like basic executive function that I think humans just have lost. Like maybe when we were like in the wilderness or whatever, even like 50 years ago, we had more things we had to do for ourselves. But I do feel like that's an important exercise for literally every human, what you just said.
That's a good point. Yeah. There's a lot of times I see in the comments, it'll be like, well, you know, I'm as a husband, I have ADHD and I need lists made for me. I'm like, no. Like, what do you do for work? Oh, I'm a project manager.
Right, right.
You're good. Make a list. Yes, you can figure it out.
Yes, yes. Well, that's the other thing, right? That is part of what you talk about a lot with the weaponized incompetence. I think people try to sort of weaponize, and again, I'm not at all dismissing people who have neurodivergence, but in neurodivergence, like fair play works really well. Like you really need systems. So it's like I don't want to hear the opposite. Well, I have ADHD, so I can't implement a system. No, the way that you sort of combat ADHD is with the systems. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And similarly, I think I use that often for men that are trying to use that as an excuse why they need things done for them. And I mean, I made it through engineering school and I made it to age 25 without a teacher.
Yes.
I think the last thing that I want to ask is, I know that you call yourself a behavior engineer shaper, and you know, before we started recording, you were talking about how you do a lot of the really boring, like gray work of this movement. And I, I got the opportunity not long ago. I went with the March of Dimes and did my first day of lobbying. And it was really boring, but it was like eye-opening. I was like,
yeah,
so this is what a lobbyist does. And there was a moment when I showed up and they're like, Zach, like, you just being a guy, and you also are 6'5", so you kind of have a commanding presence, like, just really useful to be in these rooms with you, even though, you know, we're talking about things that you don't fully understand. And so they said, here are like the 4 or 5 issues that we're looking at. Like, which one do you feel decent about just sharing a story? We went to the Massachusetts State House and we talked about the policy they were looking at. I don't remember the actual name of it, but it was getting, I think, an extra couple days of maternity leave or bereavement leave for a woman that's had a miscarriage. Because they're, especially if you're just a worker that gets minimum wage, like, you're just expected to kind of show up. And so I spoke to my experience with paternity leave and like what difference that made for me. What are some of the policy changes that are, I, as much as like getting 2 or 3 days for bereavement leave for someone with a miscarriage just is like, that's really what we're fighting for. We just have to acknowledge this is where we are. This is where the current battle is. What are some of the battles that we're like in legislation, like in policy, really working on right now?
Thank you for asking me that. And I think you know how you just said that they ask you for a story. So I want to just also say that part of the way I saw therapists using the Fair Play cards, I found really interesting, and lobbyists too, where people would just, I remember like in the beta testing phase, Zach, and all the way back probably in like 2015 or whatever, with the first iteration of the cards I had that I just made myself. And I need to send you a copy of those just for fun, because it's fun to see like the first iteration of them. But they, just asking people to you know, back up. And I'll just do that for you too, because these are like the lobbying questions that I ask when I'm in rooms. But like, I'm going to pick a card. So just, I'll just shuffle. So let's just shuffle and then you'll just pick one. Or should just tell me when to stop. Okay. Here we go. Showing up and participating. So that's just one of the Fair Play cards, right? Showing up and participating, kids. Do you have any memories of needing a parent to show up at, say, a field trip or a game of yours? Were you an athlete? Do you remember, did your parents show up for you? And what do you remember? Or do you remember when they didn't show up for you? Like, what do you remember about that?
Yeah, I remember, I didn't particularly love baseball long term, but I remember in the moment, like trying to get good at it. And I remember the coach, I think there was one time, I forget which parent it was that was supposed to pick me up, but they were a little bit late and I had to sit and be with the coach and his son for probably an extra 15, 20 minutes. And it was a little awkward. We ended up probably just playing a little extra catch and hitting balls. But like looking back on that, that was, it was a memorable moment that I haven't recalled that since it happened until right now.
Well, what's so funny about that, or not funny, but that, you know, that was, I don't know, 15 second story, but I already sort of have like a sense of, you know, what, you know, when your kid is at a extracurricular practice, you know, if you had that story, would you be upset if your partner showed up late? You know, and because you have this memory of what it feels like, how awkward it is to be the last kid picked up. Or would you show up late yourself? Because you're like, well, it's a big deal. I dealt with it. So I do feel like literally every one of these cards, we just picked one, showing up and participating. All I remember my entire life, Zach, was that I would pray, like literally like spiritually pray at night that my mother would come on one field trip. And she hates me saying this now because she's like, look, I was a single mother. Like, you can't guilt me 40 years later.
Yeah.
But I just was desperate for my mother to show up on one field trip. I was like, how cool would it be to have a parent here, you know, all of my PS 40 years, my public school years. And so I did not have a parent who showed up. And so in the beginning, I would sign up Seth for all of these field trips and school service things. And he's like, I'm not doing this. And I'm like, you have to do this. But what I was really saying was that as a child, I have this distinct memory of just feeling so sad when I wasn't the secret reader. My mom was never the secret reader, or she was never the person who showed up. And I don't even say my father, because my father wasn't even in the picture. So there wasn't even a possibility he would show up. But I think those are the stories that A, can animate the Fair Play system. You were asking before if people are really hesitant to sit down. That's another beautiful way to sort of bring them in, is just say, I'd love, even for the first 5 months of you sitting down in your check-in, just for you to tell us some stories about your childhood, because we think we know our partner so much better than we do. But those stories sort of animate what I think the most important thing is about lobbying for these issues. Because at the end of the day, the issues that I'm trying to work on now, which is why I need you to do all the culture change, is sort of these issues in, we have a policy institute. So we have a nonprofit foundation, and we're looking at the issues of fair play, which is really this idea of greedy work, you know, being able to have men step into their full power in the home and be able to parent out loud at work or caregive out loud at work in a way that doesn't penalize them the way it's penalized women. And then because that leads to then what I call fair day, which is that more CEOs will keep a hybrid workplace and not sort of force workers back 5 days a week. And or also a fair day is giving those workers you just talked about, those hourly workers, those shift workers, more control over their schedule in advance because they recognize their caregivers. So that's fair play into fair day. But then if we have fair play and fair day, then we'll probably have more fair say, which is what I say, which is like in leadership at these companies, it won't just be the white men with stay-at-home wives who are the CEOs of the companies. And then from fair say, we get to fair pay, which is what we care about, because then the more leadership that understands that women deserve equal pay for equal work and are really shouting that from the rooftops, then we sort of complete that cycle. So that's how I look at the policy work. It's fair play first, which is why we need you.
Yeah.
Because then it leads to fair day, which leads to fair say, which leads to fair pay. So that's sort of how I look at the policy work.
Got it. Yeah, and I'll try not to toot my own horn on this one.
I love you. Please toot your own horn. Because fair play is the bottom. It's our Maslow's hierarchy.
I think using some language you just had, it's like the fair day. I think I helped move. I haven't really had language for this, that's why I'm saying it is, I think I helped move the needle, at least with the company that I was at. So I was a teacher for 8 years. Our child went back to work. I was gone about 50 hours out of the home. I was like, I don't know how the fuck we're going to survive. Yeah. So I was like, I've always wanted to be in sales. Everyone said I'd be good at it. Like I should give that a shot. And I purposefully only went for a remote job so that I could be home more. So I got a sales development rep job that's making cold calls. We were making 60 cold calls a day. And then me and my friends on the team were like, okay, let's crank it up. We're doing up to like 100, 180 a day.
Wow.
At some point, we had about a year, 1 year old at the time. At some point I was our top performer. Ended up being our top performer for 2 quarters straight, would have been 3 if I didn't get promoted. And in that time, I think at one point in August, when was my first month of being our top rep, I started like kind of pushing the boundary with my manager and saying like, yeah, like, hey, sometimes I'd make up stuff. Say like, yeah, our baby's sick, or, you know, I would almost always kind of throw our baby under the bus. Reason that I need to be there. And at some point, I remember there was a really cool moment. I went off camera to change a diaper for our morning meeting. So our morning meetings weren't like, we didn't accomplish a whole lot. It was a check-in. Yes. Hey, these are the meetings we got on our calendar. Cause that was our whole job, was to book meetings for our account executives. And whenever I go off camera, I remember one of the other, the second performer on our team is like, oh, Zach's off camera. He's probably changing the diaper. And there was this moment I was like, wow, I think I'm making a difference, that I'm in it's a 40 person SDR organization. You know, 30 of them are men or boys, like, you know, 21 to probably 28. Yeah. And they're seeing an active dad in how he's adjusting the way that he works, the way that he goes about his day, still is a top performer and is an active father.
Love it.
I hadn't considered necessarily that, you know, over time, and the other top performer that was on a different team was also a dad. His kids so were a little bit older, but it was cool seeing the these 20 something year old guys like turn their heads and be like, what did he just say? Like with how I was going about my day, like, oh, well, got a poopy diaper. Like sometimes I would even jump off calls and say, hey, I just got to deal with this real quick or else the diaper rash is going to pop back up. And I remember one time, so we would do these call coaching sessions where we would put all of our calls were recorded and we would review them with 40 other sales reps listening to us on the phone. Oh my God,
that's so stressful.
And there was, yes. And there was one where our baby was crying in the background. And I said, you know, I made some comment about it. And I said, hey, excuse me for a second. I just yelled, hey, Alyssa, do you have this one? And then I came back, okay, we're good. And someone made a comment like, wow, did that help you book the call? and so I was just glad that it went on blast, that I was being an active parent while being a top performer, that I'm hoping that helped move the meter and how those young men saw their careers and saw their fatherhood, you know, 10, 15 years down the line.
I also think that that's also a great story for you to get, you know, to help people get to the table. Like if you're engaged by one of the parties, I mean, how important is that, you know, you can help men understand. And because again, this is why Fair Play is a love letter to men, because I don't ever think it's an individual man's responsibility to also topple the patriarchy. Like it's a horrible thing that our society has put you in a box where you're only defined by how many sales calls you can make or how much money you bring in. I mean, it's been a pretty dire place for men as well. And so I think understanding that you can be the both and, women have had to be the both and, because 75% of couples are dual cup, you know, configurations. And we know women shoulder 2/3 or more of what it takes to run a home and family. So women have had to do it. But men, a lot of men have had the luxury and the empathy of not having to be that engaged in their parenthood. But I think, Zach, one question I would ask you is like, do you regret time that you've spent with your kids? I mean, do you regret any of the diapers you changed? Because I can't find one. This is my love letter to men. I can't find one man in 17 countries who ever says to me, I really regret that I had to take my kids to school 3 days a week. I never hear that. I hear, you know, it's changed my life. I have a profoundly different relationship with my children. I hear things when they talk to their friends that I wouldn't normally hear. I get to be actively involved in the adenoids decision, you know, with my toddler. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if you've ever heard regret, but I actually, the love letter to me is that I only see when men are actively engaged in parenthood and in other types of caregiving that they understand that there's a benefit to them. Hmm.
That's a good point. I mean, I'm scrounging to think if I can think of one, but I'm not having any. And, you know, similar to that is I remember another nod to Alyssa is that I think in so much of the hustle culture that I probably consume online of like,
yes,
hey, you just got to put in more reps, make another video, send another DM.
Streaks, more streaks. I'm like, I hate streaks. I don't want to have a streak.
I back in October when that, you know, this practice of me being a coach was picking up, I advocated with Alyssa, you know, in our boring meeting, I was like, I would really like to open up, you know, Mondays and Tuesdays now to take extra calls so that I can possibly take on more clients. And as much as I was proud of myself for, you know, I'm working hard, you know, now it's not just 9 to 5, but it's 5 to 9, at the end. She was taking on the childcare so that I could have those extra calls. And we had this one night where she went to Boston for her work, which is, you know, 99% remote. And it was the same time as I had like 2 or 3 calls booked, which was a good night for me. And I was like, I have like, what are we going to do? And I had this moment of like defaulting, like, what are you going to do is what I was actually asking.
Yes.
And she's like, well, I don't know. I'm going to be in Boston. Like, what do you want from me? And there was this important, inflection I kind of had was like, it would probably be kind of on brand for me to say at the beginning of one of these, you know, potential sales calls that I'm like, hey, just to give you a heads up, I'm multitasking with our toddler. They're locked into their TV show for right now, but we could get interrupted, you know, during this call. And I realized that there's this over prioritization of me making money and me valuing that time differently because it had direct correlation with dollars.
Yep.
And when I was able to see that there could be blurred lines of like childcare bearing and earning money, it was like forever changed about how I see that time being spent.
Oh my God. Well, again, because women have had to do this since we've entered the paid workforce, the more, again, this is back to that, why the March of Dimes said like having a 6'5" man just there is useful because there is only so many times women can scream that there's a blurred, we're being penalized for having to do two things at once. Once the whole culture does two things at once, I do believe that those penalties will go away. I really do truly believe that not only will they go away, and that again, the movement, the gender equity part is that for women to step into their full power in the world, we need men to step into their full power in the home. That can be the sales case for women. But why I think it's so powerful for men, not just that you're changing the world by also having the same struggles, but I think for me, it was understanding that for years I'd been hearing, because it comes up in sort of our Harvard newsletters, about the longevity study that Robert Waldinger's group was doing at Harvard. And now, Zach, it's become the most popular TED Talk of all time. Literally, I think it has like, I don't know, hundreds of millions of views. And it's the talk basically is talking to men, saying that they've never had a longer study of men over 75 years of every single different socioeconomic status where they were able to control for things like genetics and smoking. And what they basically distilled men's longevity to was that the quality of a man's life at 85 can be predicted by whether he's in positive relationships at 55. And so this is literally life or death for men. That's how I look at this. Like the things that you're talking about, that you're coaching couples through, when men get to the other side of this, and it doesn't mean that it has to be perfect, as we know, and what you beautifully do is you understand this is a practice. Like I can have some days where like I feel like I'm a great athlete or like I exercise, and then the other weeks where I forget that like I can take like 2,000 steps. And that's how fair play is. There are some weeks where, you know, of course the practice is easier, and the other weeks where in those situations where you're at a standstill and you're like, okay, whose job is going to take the priority, where things get trickier, and or when there's a wild card, like a medical decision that has to be made. So it's a practice. And I guess what I just want to say is that if we look at it as life or death for men, especially because of these quality of relationships are improved by practice and emotional labor, then we can see that this is not just about like chores and housework. This is like about our, you know, our humanity.
Yeah. Well, Eve, why don't we wrap this up here? But I want to thank you so much for coming and sharing your story and giving me way less critiques than I was expecting on some of the coaching I've been giving from your book.
Not at all. I mean, again, what I just want to say is thank you for the practical, like really diving into the practical here, because one thing I want to just say is that I think in the beginning, especially in 2012, Zach, I naively thought that everybody would want a system that made their lives more efficient and easier. And that just like the workplace, if you gave them the manual, people would just automatically do it. But again, why this is the secret formula of the boundaries, systems, and communication is because your work is the container that we need to just do the system. If this was my Aunt Marion's Mahjong group, you would understand that you're kicked out of the group if you don't bring snack twice. But the home is so complicated because of our gendered assumptions, because of our religious assumptions, because of the fact that for 2,000 years we've confine women to the home. So there's lots of history that goes into why it's so hard to dismantle and even get people to the table. Mm-hmm. So all I want to say is thank you for doing that work. Thank you for practicing the boundary systems and communication on repeat that we need to keep practicing, and for helping other people shift the narrative in their own relationship. So I really, really want to say thank you.
Thank you. I got your acknowledgement.
Yes. Okay, good.
Eve, if people want to be in touch with you, if they want, obviously get the Fair Play book where she wrote it. I'm recommending mm-hmm. it. If you're here and you haven't still bought it, that's a problem. Probably get the cards after you get the book, or get right. along with yes. it, but like, yes. don't open it until you've read the book. Unicorn Space Over My Other Shoulder is her second book, which I could go into another rant about this, but
yeah, we should definitely do another podcast just on like the new data we have on creativity, longevity, resilience.
Is there a trilogy coming? Is there a third book in the works?
I think so. I think I've always wanted to do three, and I wanted to bring it full circle to what my initial practice is, like what I did for the first 10 years of, you know, before I started thinking about this book about bringing the workplace to the home. I want to bring the workplace back to the workplace. So I do want to do a Fair Play, like a lead fair to really speak to leaders and what it looks like to implement that boundary systems communication formula for organization, the work organizations.
Yeah. And I would say for people that want more information, I think the newsletter with Fair Play yes, Institute is yes. probably a great place to find you. I know you're on Instagram, Eve Rodsky, and anywhere else you want to point people to?
Yeah, I'd say Fair Play Life is where our Fair Play content is. That's where we share a lot of Zach's work. The newsletter, if you're interested in going deeper into what the research shows, how to use the cards, what happens if your partner travels, what happens if you're getting a divorce, how does Fair Play factor into custody arrangements? I mean, we have all different types of, if you're in the military, usually our newsletter will address these individual, more tricky situations. So I would say go to fairplaylife.com and sign up for the newsletter. And then also on the website is a really fun tool where if you just want to play with your kids or your partner, you're just curious about the cards, every card is there, you know, free. There's no, you know, subscription. Just click on the cards and then it'll show you what we mean by ownership of that card. So play with those conception, planning, and execution checklists. They're there on the website for anybody to access.
Awesome. Thank you, Eve.
Thanks, Zach.
Hey again, thank you for listening to that. That was a roller coaster for me. I can't tell you how excited I am that I feel like she confirmed a lot of my beliefs and way I've been going about helping people implement the Fair Play system. If you are interested in any of my programming, I would say send me a DM over on Instagram. I currently Alyssa and I are running Fair Play 101. It's a guided book forum group that is going through the book for the first time. And we're going to be working on building out a 102, which is helping to long-term implement. As I know she's said before, that it can take up to 2 years to really fully implement it. I know people need long-term support that's not as hot and heavy with weekly calls. So if you're interested, send me a DM on Instagram, just sharing your interest. We have our next Fair Play 101 coming up in July. We just finished session 2 of the one that started in May. So look forward to having more for you around this. And thank you for listening. Again, if you'd like to help me out, click the subscribe button. I don't expect you to watch every episode, but when you find something that's worth sharing, share it with people. And just let me know that you're watching. Thank you again, and hopefully deliver some more awesome stuff to you soon.